Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
Two deadly myths made it to the top. From Australia, leading scientist Andrew King finds climate change will continue for 1,000 years after net zero. Swedish scientist Wim Carton introduces us to his new book with Andrea's mom, Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. The late great journalist Ross Gelbspan told us what went wrong almost 20 years ago.
Radio EcoShock.
Winter is now spring, goes from cold snaps to heat waves, or a month of rain overnight. Welcome to the new world.
There was a plan to limit climate disasters. In 2015, 196 countries signed that plan in Paris. We are nowhere near it, but the hope was to find a resting plateau where the planet stops heating up. And that comes when we stop pushing more greenhouse gases into the sky than nature can absorb. It's called net zero. As famous Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann put it, warming ends when carbon pollution stops. New science from Australia calls all that into question. Andrew King says Earth's climate will keep changing long after humanity hits net zero emissions. Dr. King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He's been working on this question and publishing papers about it for years. Now with 11 co-authors and new approaches, King finds climate change keeps unfolding for at least the next 1,000 years. From Melbourne, Andrew King, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'd like to begin with a local prediction from your team and then work back to the global picture. If, as you say, warming continues past net zero, what does that mean for Australia?
So we anticipate lots of climate changes continuing, even if we reach net zero emissions. The globe would continue to warm a little bit, but that's reflected in different temperature changes in different parts of the world. And Australia is, being in the southern hemisphere, a bit different from many other areas of the world. And we anticipate it would warm quite substantially, even under net zero emissions, more than other parts of the world, particularly southern Australia.
And I know that most climate studies are funded and written by people in the northern hemisphere. It's almost as if the other half of Earth is not important, but it is. What are the big changes that are particular to the southern hemisphere as the world continues to warm?
We anticipate actually quite big differences between the northern and southern hemispheres under net zero emissions. In the northern hemisphere, if we look at the temperatures that countries like Canada, the US, parts of Europe and parts of Asia experience, we're not really projecting big changes under net zero, maybe very slight warming for some areas. And Arctic sea ice is expected to stabilize under net zero emissions, roughly. Whereas the southern ocean, the southern hemisphere is a different story. The southern ocean is projected to continue warming for centuries, and Antarctic sea ice, quite differently from the Arctic, is expected to decline substantially even under net zero emissions. So very big changes ongoing under net zero emissions for the southern hemisphere, and less so for the northern hemisphere. Of course, they're not really independent of each other. Changes in one part of the world can influence what happens in other parts of the world, but still quite a stark regional difference.
And as I said, Michael Mann has said warming ends when carbon pollution stops. And last year I checked that. I had trouble believing it myself. I checked it with expert Kevin Trenberth. He's in New Zealand now, and Kevin agreed. And when I raised natural feedbacks like carbon from permafrost thaw, Trenberth said the ocean's ability to capture carbon is so vast it can swallow natural sources as long as humans don't add more. Andrew, talk to us about your journey on this question and how you came to a different conclusion.
I was also kind of surprised when I learnt that this was the general consensus, that if we reach net zero, we stop warming the planet. It's kind of a conclusion that has had a lot of traction, I think, in the media, and it's quite an appealing thought. There are model experiments that suggest that climate changes under net zero might be quite small, but they're mostly quite short experiments, only for maybe 100 or 200 years. What I was interested in was taking a look at a slightly different scenario where we kind of test reaching net zero emissions at different points in the 21st century and run model simulations for 1,000 years rather than 100 or 200 years. We've only used one model, the Australian Earth System model. So, you know, that's a bit of a caveat. We would expect to see something a bit different with a different model, potentially. But with our model simulations, we do see continued warming over many centuries and continued changes in the climate system. I would say, though, I don't think this is really quite like a contradiction of what other scientists have said, like Michael Mann and Kevin Trenberth. They're mainly focused in those statements on global average temperatures, and we see quite subtle changes in global average temperatures. We do see continued warming, but the biggest changes we see in our experiments are in kind of regional changes and around Antarctica. And I think, you know, that was something that hadn't really been studied intensively. And I think our study only takes a look at this, but there needs to be much more work to understand Antarctic and Southern Ocean changes around under net zero emissions. So not quite like a contradiction as such, but there is a lot more complexity to just, rather than, I think maybe we should move away from just saying net zero means stopping global warming and just, you know, rather frame it as it, you know, being an essential step on the way to preventing dangerous climate change impacts or limiting dangerous climate change impacts. But you know, it's not the end goal. It's not the solution to all of our problems.
Reading the paper, one term that I had difficulty understanding. What is the difference between transient climate states and stabilizing climate states?
At the moment, our climate is very much changing very quickly because we're still emitting huge amounts of greenhouse gases. So the planet is warming very quickly and things are changing very quickly. So we would call this like a transient climate. But under net zero emissions, the changes do slow down. They can, you know, there are some changes happening still over time, but they are slower. And sometimes these kinds of climate states might be referred to as stabilizing or stabilized, you know, especially if the global temperature isn't changing too much. Ultimately, with the Paris Agreement, we're aiming to kind of obviously stop warming the planet and keep global warming as a whole under, preferably under 1.5 degrees, and certainly well below 2 degrees Celsius. And that, you know, implicitly requires that we're not looking at a transient climate where we've got continued warming. We're looking at a future climate. We have to be looking to have a climate in the future which is stabilizing.
And another interesting aspect of your study, suppose we wait a while, as we are doing, and emissions increase, and then humans start working on reductions in a plan. We lose, say, 5 years when action was possible. Does that matter?
I think this was something we were really interested in looking at for this study. So we did run these experiments where we had 5 years delay in reaching net zero at different points in the 21st century. And the thing that surprised me is how big a difference it makes over 1,000 years. So even if we delay achieving net zero by 5 years, in hundreds of years' time, there is a difference in the climate system, quite a substantial difference in the climate system. And I think it just highlights how urgently we need to reach net zero, because even a few years of delay, it can mean quite big differences in ocean temperatures and around Antarctica especially, which could be, you know, really devastating. So I think it just highlights the urgency of needing to reach net zero.
And this is not just about temperature change. Could you talk to us about large-scale changes to how rain falls and where it falls as warming continues?
Yeah, so under climate change at the moment, we are seeing changes in rainfall patterns around the world. We're seeing some places getting wetter, other places getting drier, many places experiencing more extreme rain as well. So we wanted to have a look and see how rainfall patterns might change under net zero emissions. And it's, again, you know, this is with one model, the Australian Earth System model, and rainfall changes are quite model dependent. So this kind of needs to be followed up in other studies. But what we find in our study is potential reversals of precipitation trends in some parts of the world. So there are areas of the world like the Mediterranean, which is getting drier, which might, under net zero emissions, actually get a bit wetter, for example. The same is true for parts of Australia, you know, and many other parts of the world. So potentially quite big changes to our water cycle and hydrological cycle that we need to better understand, to really understand the implications of net zero emissions.
Yes, when water moves, humans have to move too if agriculture can't make it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Australian climate scientist Dr. Andrew King. Your team ran 7 simulations looking at 1,000 years, that is deep future stuff. Why does the long future matter for humans now? What does it tell us?
So I think it tells us about how significant and long-lasting the impacts of our influence on the climate system are. So it's not so much about telling us about regional climate changes that we might experience over our lifetimes, but it does tell us about the impacts, the long-term impacts of policies around emissions reductions and the urgency of reaching net zero as fast as possible. And it kind of gives a warning as to kind of, yeah, these potential long-term climate changes that we might anticipate seeing that future generations will experience. It's our responsibility to not, you know, mess up the planet too much, I think. And, you know, it's really critical that we don't just do irreparable damage to the climate system over the next few years. So this helps us demonstrate how important reaching net zero as fast as possible really is.
You also looked into changes to the El Niño-La Niña cycle, known as ENSO, as the climate warms. Any tips on what you found there?
Yeah, so ENSO, the El Niño-Southern Oscillation, is really an important mode of climate variability, has big impacts on many parts of the world. And we wanted to understand if it might change under net zero emissions. And again, with the caveats of this only being a single model, you know, the need for further studies, what we found was that we anticipate ENSO amplitude to decline slightly. So what that would mean is maybe slightly weaker El Niños in future potentially then weaker impacts on regional climates. But that's starting to get a bit beyond what we got to looking at in the study. But it's something we really need to understand. We need to understand the implications of our policy goals of reaching net zero, which we have to achieve. For countries like Australia, where La Niñas do really increase the chance of having flooding rains, and El Niños really increase the chance of having drought conditions forming, if we see a change in how El Niño and La Niña behave and how they impact Australia, that could have very large effects, which we need to better understand. So it's very much, at the moment, just a hint that we might see weaker El Niños and La Niñas under net zero, but we need to do more work on this.
Well, you can't include everything, but does your study include tipping points and feedbacks, so things like radical climate change?
Tipping points is obviously a really big topic and a big concern for humanity, really. We don't explicitly look at tipping points, but the assumption would be that in an Earth system model, if it's simulating the climate system well, if there really is like a tipping point, we should be able to see that in the results. We don't really see any very, very strong evidence for a tipping point in our simulations. It partly depends on exactly how you would define a tipping point. The fact that the Antarctic sea ice continues to decline rapidly under net zero emissions, by some definitions, could be viewed as a tipping point. But we're not seeing very large kind of non-linear changes in the climate system in our model simulations that would suggest other tipping points being triggered. Again, this would be something where if we ran other model simulations for very long periods of time, that could be useful for looking into the possibility of triggering tipping points.
But even if we get human emissions under control, this investigation suggests future warming might change the season. So what does that mean?
We did look at seasonal temperature and precipitation changes, and they are a bit different under the changes under net zero emissions are a bit different between if we're looking at northern hemisphere summer or northern hemisphere winter, for example. We're not talking about really large scale changes to seasonal cycles, but kind of more subtle changes. But these changes on a local level could be quite important in some regions. If there are areas of the world which are very dependent on rains at particular times of year, and those rain-bearing weather systems move in such a way that they may experience more rain at one time of year and less in another time of year, that could have quite big impacts. It's not something we've looked at thoroughly enough yet, I think, to really say too much, but just to say that we need to study that properly, because, again, seasonal changes could have big impacts, and we need to understand any of the changes we really anticipate under net zero emissions.
Given your work, is there a stable spot for climate? Is there a resting zone for whatever survives?
At the moment, we're seeing really, really big, fast climate changes because we're emitting greenhouse gases at such a high rate. If we reach net zero, while we anticipate ongoing changes to the climate system, some of which could be really concerning and have big impacts, it's still much slower change overall than we're currently seeing. I think the point is that we shouldn't be really viewing net zero as just an end goal, because even if we achieve net zero, if we struggle to actually really have net negative emissions, so say we reach net zero and we can't really go much further than net zero, we do anticipate, you know, quite big changes, particularly to the ocean, to the cryosphere. We need to be prepared for those. But it's still, overall, we're talking about slower changes than in our current climate system. So I think, to answer your question, I think fundamentally we can't really stabilize the climate as a whole, but we can really slow down changes. And net zero is kind of an essential step on the way to doing that.
Andrew, what are you and your colleagues working on next?
Quite a lot of things to do with net zero emissions and also net negative emissions, where we are kind of studying whether, you know, how the climate might change if humans are, if humanity is successful at actually removing more carbon than it puts into the atmosphere, which we're a long way off that. But we're trying to understand regional climate changes under these kinds of scenarios. Under net zero emissions, we really need to know how climate variability will change. We need to kind of understand the types of extreme events that different parts of the world might experience and how those might evolve. We don't really have a good understanding of that yet. My group, or the people I work with, and I'm very fortunate to work with lots of enthusiastic PhD students and postdocs on this kind of topic as well, we're trying to kind of answer the questions of how the climate will evolve under net zero emissions and net negative emissions in more detail than we've really done in this first overview study.
Dr. Andrew King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He's also the chief investigator of the ARC Center of Excellence for the Weather of the 21st Century. And you can find links to his article in The Conversation and his paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for helping us understand.
No worries. Thanks for having me on the show.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Mark Twain is supposed to have said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. We are going to talk about damned and dangerous lies, I think, that we tell ourselves. We will fix climate change later, after we burn more fossil fuels. It is the myth of overshoot, and it's found in every climate agreement, official report, and business briefing books. Our guest, Wim Carton, studied it all, from new technology to the history of believing humans can rebuild the damaged atmosphere. He is the expert with dozens of papers and book chapters on carbon capture, geoengineering, and climate risks. Dr. Carton is Associate Professor of Political Ecology and Senior Lecturer at Lund University in Sweden. Along with co-author Andreas Malm, Wim's new book is Overshoot: How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. From Sweden, Wim Carton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
A couple of decades ago, I recorded talks by Dr. William Rees in Vancouver. He had charts of fish in the sea and trees on land, everything showing humans taking far more than Earth can replenish. Rees and other ecologists called that overshoot. For this new book, what do you and Andreas mean by overshoot?
Yeah, so we talk about overshoot in a more narrow sense. You're right that the original meaning of overshoot is this kind of broader, you know, transgressing ecological boundaries that comes out of the, especially ecological literature. We're talking particularly about crossing temperature targets. So within the climate literature, there's a whole conversation on overshoot, and there it means specifically going beyond thresholds that have been set by political leaders, of course. That's the kind of, you know, crudest, most simplest form of overshoot. But then if you dig a little bit deeper into this literature, there's also something that is kind of ingrained in how all of these pathways and attempts to kind of, you know, come up with ways of reaching temperature targets have come about, and all of them rely on what we call overshoot and return, or programmatic overshoot. And this is the idea that what we can cross these temperature limits and then in the future use technologies to bring it back down to them by lowering temperatures again. So we play with this kind of double notion of overshoot and overshoot in return.
In your book, you do talk about three ways that this kind of spreads out. You say, in a way, it lets us accept that we're going to go beyond the safety limits, and it involves the belief that we will come back down, and then, of course, well, will it work at all?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, so we talk about this in terms of overshoot ideology, in the sense that, you know, it's become this kind of widely accepted idea that, you know, we will be able to do this, and that this is in a way the only way to do it, right? To the only way to, you know, reach these ambitious mitigation climate targets is to go through overshoot. That's become like the dominant idea, and it's a belief that it's based on what we call this kind of unicorn technology, right? It's a wide spread of contraptions, I mean, both technological but also natural, that can suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. And the whole problem with that is exactly that they, for the most part, continue to justify and legitimize business as usual. So they kind of just provide an excuse to, you know, just keep going in the meantime, right? So the kind of fantastical nature of these technologies justifies this notion that we can just continue with business as usual in the near term.
In an article in The Conversation, you and Andreas say, quote, mainstream climate science endorsed the fantasy of a global warming time machine. So are you saying even top-level science, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change experts, bought into overshoot?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in many ways, overshoot in its kind of, you know, temporary crossing overshoot and then coming down again comes out of exactly this literature. So if you go back in time to, you know, some of the kind of the first IPCC reports in the early 2000s, so the fourth, around the fourth and fifth disaster report, then it's exactly there that the whole notion of overshoot came about in a way. So, I mean, what happened essentially is that at a certain point, political leaders came up with this 2-degree temperature limit, and then they went to scientists, in particular a group of modelers called integrated assessment models that are very kind of central in the work of the IPCC, and ask them to, you know, provide ways of reaching these 2-degree targets. And we can talk a lot about the details here. I'm not going to go into too much of it, but the models work in a very particular kind of neoclassical economics way that is, you know, rather conservative in terms of boundaries that it works within. And so within those boundaries, they could not stay within 2 degrees because the model didn't allow for sufficiently rapid, I mean, capital destruction, for example, phasing out fossil fuel, all these things were not possible within the limits of that conservative model. And so what they had to do to kind of square that circle was to come up with overshoot. And this is where it originated, and then it got mainstreamed after the Paris Agreement, and from there fed back into policy, and now I would argue also in a lot of, like, corporate reports and so on. So sadly, you know, part of the scientific community is definitely part of it.
And you look back into the history of this kind of thinking, right back to the 1970s, and I found it interesting that at that time they were quite willing to say, well, look, this is a way we can keep on with our fossil fuel burning if we just have this overshoot idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is in this book, Overshoot, that just came out, right? We talked about this particularly in terms of carbon capture and storage. So this original technology to put a carbon capture device on a fossil fuel power plant, for example. And in many cases, and this is still the case at the moment, right? This was meant to just, you know, produce CO2 that could then be pumped back underground to basically extract more oil and more gas. Because you increase the pressure, and that's been one of the main ways of CO2 capture at a chimney for most of the history of this technology, actually. Could we have a second book coming, actually, it's going to be released next year, that delves much deeper into all kinds of other technologies as well, not just carbon capture and storage, but also these newer ones. And even there, if you go back to the 70s, right, it's very interesting how all of the kind of narrative in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was about how do we find ways to continue pumping and combusting fossil fuels by time, essentially, because mitigation, rapid phase-out, was just not seen as conceivable or politically desirable. So all these technologies had this at the core of their development narrative.
And then we had a series of pretty serious reports. I reported on them into the supposed safe limit of 1.5 degrees C of warming and the predictions it would come in the 2040s. And then that was sort of moved to the 2030s. And now the last 12 months are already over 1.5 degrees C. What is the next limit being proposed? And what do these limits mean? Is there any point to it?
This is a very good question. It's very hotly debated at the moment, even among scientists. I know just the other day there's been a few papers by people either trying to, you know, dismiss and downplay the role of these limits, and then others kind of fiercely defending them. So it's a very active debate. I guess there's two things here. I mean, one is that politically the 1.5-degree target has had, it's been a Trojan horse for overshoot and for carbon removal. That's very clear now. But it's also had this enormous catalyzing effect, right? It came out of the demands of small island states and developing countries. It was picked up by climate movements.